the belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama,
four score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty.
I guess I really don't know what Christmas is all about.
Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Charlie Brown, I can tell you what Christmas is all about.
You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Hello, this is Michael Hart, and you are listening to Unknown America, Myths and Little Known Oddities about the Greatest Nation on Earth. Each and every week at, about the same time, we try to get these things out on Wednesday, a little bit late this particular week, we like to share with you things that are going on in the nation and the world around us today through the prism of history. We firmly believe that if you are not up to speed with your American history, then the news of the day, the things that are going on around us, simply do not make as much sense as they should. In this particular episode, is the end of the Electoral College imminent? The Electoral College has, of course, come under fire many, many, many times over the course of the last couple of hundred years in this country. It wasn't thought to be so conspiratorial back in the Founding Fathers' days, with Washington being the very first president elected under the original Electoral College. But the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact could bring all of that to an end. The NPVIC is an agreement among a group of U.S. states and Washington, D.C. to circumvent the current Electoral College by awarding all of their electoral votes to whichever presidential candidate wins the overall popular vote in the 50 states and the District of Columbia. The compact is designed to ensure the candidate who receives the most votes nationwide is elected president, and it only comes into effect when it would guarantee that outcome. The Electoral College, of course, sets a very high bar that irks politicians whose base is in the big cities. But this is also by design. Right from the beginning, one reason the Electoral College even came to exist was because of the big cities and requires some geographic balance in our politics. The Electoral College is a two-step democratic process. A lot of people, you know, obviously we've had the conversations in the past in this country about the popular vote versus the delegate vote. Most people don't realize that the President of the United States is not really voted into office until December after the November general election. That's when the delegates meet in their respective state capitals. Each state gets the same number of electoral votes as it has representation in D.C., in other words, representatives and senators. This means that small states get at least three, and big states will, of course, get more, California, for example, having 55, two senators and their 53 respective House districts. To win the White House requires a majority of electoral votes. All this means is that no one can win the White House by running up huge support in just one region of the country or a collection of big cities. Even overwhelming popularity in places like New York and Los Angeles is not enough to win. Middle America gets a say in the equation as well. Now, one of the reasons that I wanted to get into this is because the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, or again, the NPVIC, is gaining in both support, momentum, and states that are in fact signing on. And considering the intent of the Electoral College, in a recent trip that I took to San Francisco, it really stuck me that the fact of the matter is that this could actually come into play, and it could come into play within the next election cycle. Probably not the election in November of 2020, but certainly shortly after that. People like Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton have repeatedly called for getting rid of the Electoral College. Warren and Clinton have endorsed the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact as a plan to nullify the Electoral College without changing the Constitution. This is simply an agreement because the individual states determine how their electors are actually either held accountable or even elected, for that matter. Some states even allowing you to switch your vote after you're elected in. The NPVIC would change how states select presidential electors, the people who cast the state's electoral votes. Under it, states would ignore their own voters and instead choose electors based on the national vote. This would manipulate the Constitution and create a direct election for president, an outcome that was adamantly rejected by the Constitutional Convention. Now, the NPVIC is backed by a well-funded California-based campaign led by a guy by the name of John Koza, one of the left's mega donors. His money comes from inventing the scratch-off lottery tickets used by states to run lottery monopolies. The NPV campaign has spent millions lobbying legislators and taking them on expensive paid vacations to places like Hawaii and Puerto Rico. It takes effect if states that sign on to the compact, representing at least 270 electoral votes, come to support it. As you're aware, it takes 270 to elect a president. Well, that seems like an awful lot of states. Well, not when you consider the fact that places like California, with their 55, have agreed to support this initiative. Currently, the way this stands is the MPVIC does not kick in until there are enough states signed on to represent a minority of 270 electoral votes, thus guaranteeing a popular vote for the president. Currently, there are 15 states and Washington, D.C., representing 196 electoral votes. That's what's passed legislation to join this compact. This puts the compact nearly three-fourths of the way to taking effect. The NPVIC would shift more power to larger cities. And because it has no majority requirement or runoff system, it would allow candidates to win with smaller and smaller pluralities. This would encourage splinter parties and spoiler candidates that could produce dramatically anti-democratic outcomes. We hear a lot of talk in America about having a viable third party or a fourth party even. And although the two-party system is far from perfect and there do need to be other voices that are heard, the simple reality is multi-parties in a multi-party democracy, because people need to realize Adolf Hitler was elected, that in multi-party democracies, you have the possibility of electing a president on a popular vote without even a majority. It's just the majority out of the voters. I'm talking about over 50%. These are some of the reasons why most major countries elect their presidents or prime minister with a two-step process, like the parliamentary systems in Canada and Great Britain. A vast and diverse nation like the U.S. needs systems that push politicians to consider the interest of many different kinds of people. And the Electoral College obviously helps us to do this. But you have politicians that represent some of the larger districts, some of the more liberal states, again, such as California and New York, that are much more interested in leaning on the popular vote, and particularly, and the funny thing is, the NPVIC actually would be a more efficient way than even in from their perspective than a national popular vote. It takes the vote, it takes the decision out of the actual voter itself. Again, the compact is designed to ensure that the candidate who receives the most votes nationwide is elected. As of February of this year, this particular month, it's already been adopted, like I said, by 15 states with 196 electors. The compact would modify the way participating states implement Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 of the Constitution, which requires each state legislature to define a method to appoint its electors to vote in the Electoral College. The Constitution, however, does not mandate any particular legislative scheme for selecting its electors, and instead allows the state legislatures with the exclusive power to choose how to allocate their state's electors. Although systems that violate the 14th Amendment, which mandates equal protection of law and prohibits racial discrimination, would be prohibited. States have chosen various methods of allocations over the years. Some actually base it upon the popular vote. Others are just going to give a fraction of the vote predicated on the total turnout. In other words, this guy gets 40% of the vote, so he gets 40% of the electors. It's different from state to state to state. States have chosen, again, these various methods of allocations over the years with regular changes in the nation's early decades. But today, all but two states, that being Maine and Nebraska, award their electoral votes to the single candidate with the most votes statewide, the so-called winner-take-all state. Maine and Nebraska currently award one electoral vote to the winner in each congressional district, and the remaining two electoral votes go to the statewide winner. So as you can see, in fact, it does vary, but not only does it vary, but it allows for the opportunity of interpretation. The project, the MPVIC, has been supported by editorials, including in the New York Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, the LA Times, the Boston Globe, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, arguing that the existing system discourages voter turnout and leaves emphasis only on a few states and a few issues, while popular election would equalize voting power. Others, of course, have argued against it, including the Wall Street Journal, which has called the project an urban power grab that would shift politics entirely to urban issues in high population states and allow lower caliber candidates to run. A collection of readings pro and con has been assembled by the League of Women Voters. Now, opponents of a national popular vote contend that the Electoral College serves to protect the country from the election of a person who is unfit to be president. You could make the argument, and we won't do that here, but you could make the argument that we have quite a few people serving in Washington, D.C. at many different levels of government that are unqualified or underqualified at the very least. Several of the founders conceived the Electoral College as a deliberative body, which would weigh the impetus and inputs on the state, but not be bound by them in selecting the president. However, the Electoral College has never served such a role in practice. From 1796 onward, and this is one of the main cons, I guess you could say, from the perspective of the left, from 1796 to the present day, presidential electors have acted, according to them, as rubber stamps for their party's nominees. No election outcome has been determined by an elector deviating from the will of their state, and 29 states in D.C. have laws punishing what they call faithless electors. The issue then becomes the population centers themselves and the possibility that not only could the will of the individual state voters be changed, but in addition to that, the fact that the compact itself could be responsible for electing either very undesirable candidates or very underqualified candidates. And when you look at the current status of American politics and the shift we have in this country that has shifted so far left and it's given us the recent political debacles that we've had in this country, and again, you know what they are, so I won't elaborate, but the United States of America does have these splinter groups, whether it's the Justice Democrats or Democratic Socialism or whatever the case may be. The MPVIC compact gives a very real opportunity for those political views to not only take hold, but to flourish through the implementation or the expression of candidates that would, well, check the status quo, if you will. One of the reasons that this concerns me is not only the support that it has gained amongst some high-ranking Democrat officials, but just the general tone of our inner cities, of our urban centers. About 3 or 4 weeks, I'll just go ahead, it was about the second week in January of 2020, me, along with several members of my family, traveled to San Francisco, California, wine country, and you know, Napa Valley area, for just some R&R. I found it to be a beautiful place. Yes, unfortunately, much of what we heard about the homelessness does in fact exist, but it was a charming place. The food was great. We had a wonderful time. But it was absolutely apparent. There was no doubt in any way, shape, or form. You could not miss the fact that it was very obvious that San Francisco, California, is a bastion of liberalism. I would go into gift shops, and there would be socks, stockings, things to go on your feet, socks with the images of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. That in and of itself is not an issue. However, what is of issue is the ones that were speaking to Donald Trump, how he must go. There were impeachment socks. There was nothing pro-Republican. It wasn't just anti-Trump either. It was anti-Republican. There was billboards around town and on the benches of buses for bus stops with the slogan, build bridges, not walls. And it wasn't like it was this part of San Francisco or that. It was everywhere. It was pervasive no matter where I went. Traveling into the city to do some shopping prior to planned evening out of the town, we were taking an Uber, and as we were going through town, I gazed upon a building with a five-story, no exaggeration, five-story likeness of climate change or environmental activist, if you will, Greta Thunberg. An entire side of about a 35-foot building. 35-story, pardon me. The entire side. The reason I bring this up is because in an environment where states could be encouraged to adopt this particular compact, if you will, the MPVIC, it dawns on me that although people in America obviously have access to the news and access to their devices and access to MSNBC or Fox News or wherever they choose to get their news, that in some cities in America, there's a real air, if you will, of politicization. Politics is it's ever present. It's everywhere. Because what I saw wasn't, again, isolated. It was absolutely everywhere I looked. And in an environment where we're trying to change the viewpoints of people or encourage certain states to adopt certain new policies or eradicate the Electoral College in this particular case, it seems to me that the incessant, I hate to use the term brainwashing or indoctrination. I would like to think that Americans are smart enough to, on their own, to draw their own conclusions, and factually so. Unfortunately, over the years, I have been proven wrong. But with that said, it makes me wonder, ponder, even worry to a degree, that the realities, the political realities in this country are being diluted from people that would have a responsibility for voting, because you got to remember, electors are elected. They appear on a ballot. If people in our larger urban cities are receiving a constant intellectual diet of one political view versus another, then the likelihood of more and more people supporting the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact becomes a very, very harsh reality. It moves beyond the possible to the plausible. And it is something that is in direct violation of everything the Founding Fathers thought about electing the president. Now, there's been debate over the years whether or not the Electoral College favors small or large population states. Those that argue the college favors low population states point out that such states have proportionally more electoral votes relative to their populations. In the least populated states, with three electors, this results in voters having 143% greater voting power than they would have under purely proportional allocation, while in the most populous state, California, voters' power is 16% smaller than that of proportional allocation. According to those that support it, the MPVIC would give equal weight to each voter's ballot, regardless of what state they live in. But is that a credible argument? Essentially, what they're saying here is that because of the number of people that live in California, they should have more electors. Others, however, believe that since most states award electoral votes in a winner-take-all system, the potential of populous states to shift greater numbers of electoral votes gives them more clout than would otherwise be expected, according to some detractors. In a report released in October of 2019, the Congressional Research Service stated that, quote, whether the MPV initiative requires congressional consent under the Compact's first clause requires a determination as to whether MPV even constitutes an interstate compact. Now, a compact clause of Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution states that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into any agreement or compact with another state. The CRS report cites the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Virginia versus Tennessee back in 1893, reaffirmed in U.S. Steel Corporation versus Multi-State Tax Commission, as stating that words of agreement or compact are synonymous, that explicit congressional consent of interstate compacts is not required for agreements which the United States can have no possible objection to or have any interest in interfering with, close quote. While explicit congressional consent of interstate compacts is required when the underlying compact is, quote, directed to the formation of any combination tending to increase the political power in the states, which may encroach upon or interfere with the just supremacy of the United States, meaning where the vertical balance of power begins and the federal government and state government is altered in favor of state governments. However, Yale Law School professor, his name is Akhil Amar, one of the compact's framers, has argued that the MPVIC does not create a new interstate government apparatus, and because cooperating states are acting together, would be exercising no more power than they are entitled to wield individually. The MPVIC probably does not constitute an interstate compact, and conversely, the Congressional Research Service report cites the court's opinion in Northeast Bancorp versus the Federal Reserve Board of Governors as suggesting that a requirement of a new interstate government entity is sufficient but not a necessary condition to qualify an agreement as being interstate compact under the clause. And the legal challenges go on from there. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds about it, but at the end of the day, it is very important that people realize that we have a move in this country today, one that's gaining in momentum, one that is vibrant, one that has got a lot of support from a lot of people within primarily the Democrat Party that support the idea of the states getting together pre-election. They would know prior to a presidential election whether or not they have the votes to overrule the voters in their respective states and assign all of their electoral votes to the popular national vote outcome in November. Keep an eye on this one, folks. It is something that could absolutely positively shift the direction of power in the United States. It undoubtedly would meet constitutional challenges, as it seems, as we have reported over a moment ago, it would seem to be in direct conflict with the supremacy of the United States government, However, no court case yet has set the precedent that is suggesting that the states would not have the right to enter into such an agreement. And in a media-driven world where there's so much disinformation and misinformation, false information, and five-foot-tall murals of climate activists and banners across cities for all intent and purposes indoctrinating and or misinforming American voters, the possibility of a national popular vote interstate compact coming to life, coming to fruition, and coming to an election in the very near future is a very real possibility, and yet again is another justification for each and every one of you, regardless of what your political stripe is, to make your voices heard each and every election day, to participate where you can in rallies and town halls, to ask questions, to hold your media accountable, to not always trust everything that the media is in fact telling you or saying to you, and always question everything you hear, because there is indeed an attempt in this country to shape and mold the way each of us believes for the purposes of political gain, expediency, and power. It's been going on for many, many, many years, but this particular monster is gaining in momentum, and it is something that's gaining in momentum by way of a media that's either complicit or simply incompetent, but either way, the outcome is the same. You've been listening to the Unknown America, Myths and Little Known Oddities about the Greatest Nation on Earth, right here on the Heart of America Broadcasting Network. We do ask that you share this particular podcast with your social media, with your family, with your friends. And each and every week, keep an eye open for additional segments and episodes of this particular podcast as we continue to break down the news of the day through the prism of the past. This is Michael Hart. We hope you'll check us out at Heart of America, our live radio broadcast, every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern. And you can listen to that at Heart, H-A-R-T, heartofamerica.net, as well as check out the book, Unknown America, over at theunknownamerica.com. That's theunknownamerica.com. You've been listening to the Unknown America Project right here on the Heart of America Broadcasting Network. Until we meet again.
The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama,
fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty.
I guess I really don't know what Christmas is all about.
Isn't there any